But right now, it's time for Oh, the Humanities, taking a look at humanities event scholarship and research happening on campus. Ordinarily joined by Max Orr, today we are joined by Rachel Shavitz, Chapel Hill Town Council member, and here with the Carolina Public Humanities. Rachel, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing good. So I'm going to turn it over to you. What is going on and coming up? We've got an event happening still a couple of weeks away that people can sign up for,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah, we know that lots of people travel over the summer, and so we don't really host as many events as we do during the fall and the spring semesters. But this year, on Saturday, July 14th, is Bastille Day, and we thought, oh, there are so many Francophiles in the Triangle area, and Saturday is the day when we host our all-day seminars. Wouldn't it be awesome to put together something on Bastille Day? And so with Lloyd and Max and all the batch of Francophiles that I have the pleasure of working with, they came up with
She did not use air quotes on pleasure there, FYI.
This talk, this all-day seminar on the pleasures and complexities of French culture.
Awesome.
And I have with me today one of our speakers, who is Dr. Jessica Tanner. She's assistant professor of French at UNC.
Jessica, good to be with you today.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Awesome. So this event is on Bastille Day all day long on campus. If you're listening out there, as we're talking and you get interested, you want more information, humanities.unc.edu is the website for Carolina Public Humanities. So it's on Bastille Day, but it's not about the French Revolution or
we
the
did that
specific
earlier.
Events. Right. So this is about French culture,
exactly.
Right? Just in general. So what are the two of you going to be talking about?
You want to kick Jessica? It off, Jess?
Yeah.
You're
so,
first.
I remember when Rachel sent me the email asking me to do this, and I've done lots of CPH events previously and loved them, but I think your email said, can you do something about French literature? And I was like, sure.
Such a narrow field. And there's only 80 million people.
So it's been a fun and intimidating challenge to sort of figure out what doing something on French literature would be. So my talk is called, I think, Writing France, Revolutions in Modern French Literature. And I decided just to take the lens of change, this perception that there's an accelerating pace of change after the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. There's 8 regime changes, I think, over the course of the 19th century, and then with globalization and technology these days, the sense that things are continuing to accelerate. Yeah. So looking at the ways in which literary texts negotiate and create change.
That's basically. Actually, I mean, it kind of puts it all into perspective. Like, I'm hearing you saying that, and it's like, well, that doesn't really narrow it down either, because
nope.
We've been dealing with rapid revolutionary change for the last 200 plus years, but
exactly.
That puts that into perspective too, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. So it's sort of trying to bring together these things that look incredibly disparate and respect the differences between these historical moments, but also to trace this thread through. To show that in some ways these patterns we see today already happened,
so
you know, at different moments.
What or who are you going to be focusing on?
Mm-hmm. So I've been trying to figure that out actually all day, inspired by this. I'm trying to focus on different moments. So this moment right after the French Revolution, when particularly aristocratic men usually felt like they'd lost all distinctiveness and were very sort of emo before their time.
Walking around with copies
who
of
Goethe. Who am I? Where
their,
am I?
Yeah.
You know, where's my place in society? Moving through a couple of the revolutionary moments in the 19th century, looking at Haussmannization, so this process of renovation of Paris, and the way that shows up in literature in during the Second Empire in the 1850s and 60s. And then the Paris Commune, the Franco-Prussian War, which caused sort of a sense of crisis of nationalism,
oh, right.
Which has a lot of echoes today as France lost Alsace and Lorraine. And then the World Wars, decolonization, and then a couple of different moments from contemporary times. So mostly there's a lot of canonical authors, Balzac, Zola, Flaubert, and then some contemporary ones too. I'm a 19th century person by training and teaching and research, so you can kind of see my
awesome.
Bias showing. And some sort of lesser known texts as well, just to give them a taste of, you know, what else is out there beyond the canon.
Go back for a second. The renovation of Paris in the 18... Okay, I know nothing at all about this. What
so
happened?
So, over the... I mean...
I just reached into, like, of the 10 things you mentioned,
no,
I just pulled out the most
the
obscure
one.
I was like,
most,
what is
so
that?
You chose
the,
well.
Yeah.
Over the course of these 2 decades, although a lot of historians and urban studies folks have shown that these processes started much earlier, this period of 2 decades, basically, Napoleon III, who was the emperor during the Second Empire, and Haussmann, who was the prefect of Paris, decided to basically completely reimage Paris and destroyed all of the old medieval streets that were considered, you know, dirty, unhealthy, unsanitary, in the effort to, as I said, aerate, beautify, and there's another one that I'm forgetting right now, the city. So the creating all the sort of images we see that we associate with modern Paris today, the big boulevards, mm-hmm. sort of regularized architecture of six-story buildings, all that dates to that time. And it was considered incredibly disorienting by many of the authors at the time. So Baudelaire famously will talk about how, you know, old Paris is no more, hélas. It's what is it like to feel? Because the way that we identify ourselves is so dependent on place. What is it like to have that place no longer be recognizable over the you know, span of just two decades? All of a sudden, you don't recognize the city that you're from.
Because you go to Paris now, or like you go to Paris like you do. I went there once 20 years ago, but like part of old Paris is still there, right?
Yeah,
you still have those
absolutely.
Kind of narrow, kind of winding streets. And people today look at that and say, that's confusing. Give me the boulevards.
Yeah, exactly. Although I was surprised when I led the UNC Study Abroad program in summer. In Paris a couple years ago, and my students were completely bored by the Haussmannized,
big time.
Modern regularized architecture, and they were only into like the medieval sort of Marais and
those
like,
kind
the
of
Latin
windy streets. Like that's the best part.
Exactly.
Yeah? Yeah.
Exactly. So while you know this was the sort of attraction for a lot of people at the time coming into Paris, this sort of modern city. It's fairly regularized, which was the goal, but it, you know, can seem kind of
it's confusing in the old part, but it's a lot more fun.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The authors thought so too.
Yeah. Okay. So speaking with Jessica Tanner, who's going to be one of four presenters at this Bastille Day event. Again, humanities.unc.edu is the website. And since Jessica was talking about sort of the place and kind of the visual look and feel of things, let's move to the visual medium and talk cinema with Rachel Shavit. So what are you going to be talking about?
So my talk is called France, the Birthplace of Cinema. And so I really do start with the very beginning with the Lumière brothers and the Georges Méliès and the birth of cinema and watching it shift from being sort of this fairground attraction that travels from place to place, which is how the Lumière brothers saw it, and how Méliès was able to make it worthy of a theater and shift it from being this Nickelodeon for traveling around in very sort of low-rent, low-class, fairground trick to something that could be artistic, that could be worthy of a theater like a play.
And Méliès, for people who don't know, is famous for The Trip to the Moon,
exactly,
right?
Exactly right. Yeah. And so from there, I just kind of track the progress of French cinema up till today, and I use some little exemplars to show off French terms that we all use in filmmaking today that they coined or they championed, and then everybody else kind of got on board. So something like mise en scène, which talks about everything you can see in the frame. So costume, lighting, the shot composition, where the actors are placed, everything you can think of. So if you can imagine that sort of absurd looking gesture that directors make when they put their fingers together and they're framing the shot and their one eye is closed and they're looking through. It's so over the top. The idea of that is making sure that what you're trying to get across is visible within the frame and what is your mise-en-scene.
Cool.
Yeah. So I just kind of go through a couple other terms and looking at French films and talking about how over the last 100 years, France has had to distinguish itself from Hollywood and how they've been able to do so and make a very distinct, unique French cinema that is recognizable as a French and a unique cinema and can try to compete with the sort of dominant, just ubiquitous Hollywood cinema that has taken over the rest of the world.
So you're going to talk about Godard, right?
Of course, the French New Wave. Are you a fan?
I am, yeah. Well, when you were talking about like distinguishing from Hollywood,
right.
You've got Godard, who's like really obvious about that and makes that overt on screen, right?
And what's funny about the French New Wave filmmakers, and they were critics first and then became filmmakers, they were not really critical of Hollywood. They were critical of people who did the same thing over and over, who were just placing actors in a place to act out the scenes, that they weren't being creative. They didn't have a unique vision. You couldn't tell their fingerprint. And so there were some Hollywood directors who had who were auteurs, and they would have considered many of the directors working today auteurs, people whose films don't look like anybody else's films. So when I talk about auteur theory of contemporary, I'll point to like Tarantino.
Yep.
his films don't look like other people's films. Yep. And I look at Guillermo del Toro, who won the Oscar for the Best Picture for Shape of Water last year. His films don't look like anybody else's films. And you can tell his unique vision seeping through in every frame of that film. Mm. And that is what the French New Wave directors and critics were really championing and loving, and what they aim to do in their own films.
I love the fact that, and I was thinking about this in the context of art, because in MoMA up in New York, there's this room that's full of Mondrian works and a couple of other artists like Mondrian, and you close your eyes and you picture Mondrian, you've got those like shapes and lines and that's it. And there are other artists that did exactly the same thing, but you can tell the Mondrians from the non-Mondrians. And Tarantino's the same way,
right.
In Del Toro. He's got, and Tarantino in particular, inspired a whole generation of imitators.
Absolutely.
Who do exactly the same thing, but you can tell when it's Tarantino. Right. Yeah.
And they were working, I mean, at least at this stage in their careers, they're working in a really rigid studio system,
mm-hmm.
with unbelievable demands from their producing studios and all of the investment makers that need their return on their investment, and yet they're still able to infuse it with that creative vision. And I would argue Tarantino has drifted from that in later years, but in the beginning he was a true auteur in that way, and Del Toro still is, which mm-hmm. is so exciting that he can sort of thread this needle of, I mean, he won Best Picture. He can do anything he wants now,
yeah.
which is so fascinating and exciting to think that we have someone who kind of doesn't care what the industry is demanding and is able to turn out a film that's so magnificent that it wins this great award, and now he can do whatever he wants.
Speaking with Rachel Shavitz and Jessica Tanner, humanities.unc.edu is the website. They're both going to be speaking at this event commemorating Bastille Day, but about French culture and literature and film and everything else. Go to that website for more information on how you can sign up. So we've been speaking with both of you kind of individually. How do you speak to each other?
We were actually just talking about this as we were getting ready to come in here and realizing how many points of contact
mm-hmm.
there will be. I think both of us are going to be, you know, talking about these different moments, but many of them overlap. And when you were talking about sort of the situation in contemporary film in France and this sort of abandonment of the desire to try to be, to compete with Hollywood, you see similar things going on in literature. An anxiety about the fact that most French novels these days are not translated, for instance, into English. And how to sort of negotiate that in a country where, you know, people still read novels more, at least, I think, than, or they play a larger part in popular culture and mass culture than they do in the United States.
Mm.
So there's lots of points of commonality, and also the aesthetic changes, I would imagine, you know, that happen in film at certain moments, like after World War II, you know, there's a complete overhaul. It completely ruptures the way that aesthetics look and realistic representation and things like this, and that happens both in literature and in film.
And I think we were also talking about the context of the situation where the artists were working. So back to your point about the revolutionary changes happening mm-hmm. just to the street topography of Paris and how that had a massive impact on authors. And so a lot of when I'm looking at films in France, I'm looking at what was happening in the country at the time when these artists were creating their work, and how did that impact the way that they told their stories, the mm-hmm. stories they chose to tell. The artistic aesthetic, the look of the films is dramatically different based on what's happening and the politics of the country, which were, like, let's be real, like the most insane roller coaster mm-hmm. of the last 100 years. And we see that up through till today. And so that's a really fascinating connection too between how the context of the time affects authors and filmmakers.
Who else is going to be speaking?
I was going to say, I think that'll also show up in the other two talks.
Yeah.
So Dan Sherman, who is a professor of art history and history at UNC, is talking about French art. It's the art of Frenchness, visual artists, and a changing nation. And then Mike Garval, who's a professor at NC State and a specialist in 19th century literature and food, is giving a talk called Food and Modern French Cultural Identity, A Legacy of Refined Cuisine and Influential
will
Chefs.
Will there be samples?
There will be.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that was a shot in the dark.
So there's like a very special French lunch. So there'll be two talks, Jess's and mine, and then we'll have a lunch break that's going to have a completely French lunch with French wine.
Nice.
And then the final two talks. And I think, I'm sure that when we do the food talk, there'll be some some extras. I don't know exactly what Michael's plan is, but we're certainly hoping to put that together. So, yeah, you can't talk about food and not try
and
it.
And not have
Come
food,
on.
Right?
That's totally not okay.
I'm not sure if it's, I'm, like, glad to be before the wine or if it'd be better to be after.
Like, come after, and everyone's like, oh, this is the greatest talk
great.
Of all
or
time.
Yeah.
Other information that people need to know about this event or other upcoming events on campus?
I think this event, the only other thing I would add is that we do have a collaborative partner. We're working with the Center for European Studies, who we've worked with many times before. And so we're hosting the event in the FedEx building on UNC's campus, thanks to the collaboration of the Center for European Studies. And as you've mentioned many times, to sign up, people just need to visit humanities.unc.edu. It will be our last event for the summer. And then we take a little break so people can relax. And honestly, we can't recruit any faculty in late July in August anyway, so
even if
we tried, we couldn't do it. But then we'll be back in the fall to have a full spectrum of other events coming up.
Awesome. Humanities.unc.edu is the website. Go there, get more information about that and other events on and around campus. Rachel Shavitz, Jessica Tanner, thank you so much.
Thank you.